Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For this Thursday, we're going to talk about the cosmos this hour. And our guest is Bob Berman. The latest special issue of Astronomy is Bob Berman's 50 Weirdest Objects in the Cosmos, Your Guide to the Strangest and Most Fascinating Oddities in the Universe. It not only is interesting questions and finds, but it's a beautiful magazine as well. So Bob is joining us this hour. Bob is one of the best known and most widely read astronomers in the world. He's perhaps uniquely able to translate complex scientific concepts into language that is understandable to those of us who are interested in this topic, but find it kind of complicated sometimes. He's written for Discover Magazine, Astronomy, The Old Farmer's Almanac. He's the author of 7 books, and his newest and most epic, The Sun's Heartbeat, will be published this July. And he is our guest this hour. He starts What is Weird, his column that starts this whole issue. The enjoyable task of creating this collection of celestial oddities began with an obvious question. What makes something weird? And we'll ask him that. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. And thank you, Bob, very much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, great to have you here. So my son and I were talking about, I was showing him some of the pictures, and his question, because I was reading him some facts, you know, let's add to our base of knowledge. 125 billion galaxies fill the known universe. And he asked me, well, how do we know how many galaxies there are? And I said, well, I'll ask Bob.
That's actually the easy part. We just count the number of galaxies in a certain amount of the sky, like a square degree of sky, and then you extrapolate for the entire sky.
Oh.
And then you figure that there are some galaxies in the distance, a lot of galaxies, that are too faint to be seen, and you account for those, and then there's the answer. Of course, that's all thrown into disarray if the universe is actually infinite, as there's more and more evidence that it is. In that case, there's no limit to the number of galaxies.
Wow.
But let's take that as a minimum, though.
Okay. Do you think the universe is infinite?
Yes.
You do?
Yes.
Isn't that a hard thing to take into your mind? It's infinite?
No, it's not hard. It's impossible.
It sure is impossible. All right, so you're putting together this fabulous issue, and you ask yourself, what makes something weird? And you answer,
well, first of all, it has to be unique or almost close to unique. For example, the sun is amazing in many, many ways. But is it weird? No, because there are many stars just like it. But if you get a planet like Saturn, that has this strange hexagon at its north pole that doesn't go away and that revolves with the planet, even though winds are blowing right through it, that's weird. So something that we haven't seen before, or better yet, something that is so unique that we can't even begin to explain what it might be, that qualifies.
And I guess number one on this is really an interesting picture, and we have no idea what these things are. These, what do you call them, the Fermi bubbles, double bubble, toil and trouble, you call it?
Yes.
What are these things?
Well, you know, that's a great question, Kathleen. they were just discovered 10
they were?
Months ago. I mean, just less than a year ago. This is brand new stuff.
Oh.
And nobody has a clue what this is. This is, it may be an entirely new phenomenon. It's not every day that we find something that's absolutely outside our realm of experience. To try to explain it, what they are, at least, is they're two enormous bubbles. When I say enormous, I mean almost the size of galaxies.
Ooh.
That are above and below the flat plane of our galaxy. Our galaxy is flat like a CD or like a vinyl record, if people still remember vinyl records. And picture two bubbles, one kind of balanced on the top of the vinyl record, just barely touching in the center, and then another bubble sticking to the bottom of the vinyl record, also attached at the center, so that the two bubbles are sort of meeting each other, so that they form a kind of figure eight shape. the bubbles surround nothingness, and they're expanding. So what could that be? And they're made of gamma rays, the most powerful energies in the universe.
Hmm.
Gamma rays isn't light stuff. It's not the kind of materials you can just brush off. Gamma rays are given off in supernova explosions. So it's as if tens of thousands of exploding stars are going off constantly in these places, but they're not. I mean, we'd see them. Those are super bright.
Right.
And there's nothing there at all. And if there were two bubbles and they were both centered on the center of the galaxy where there's a black hole at least, okay, then you'd say, well, something's strange going on with the black hole. But the bubbles are centered on nothingness, and yet they take up a huge amount of our sky. If you look toward the south, they take up half the southern sky. And what could possibly do it? And at least astronomers are all in agreement in their answer. They all say, we have no idea.
So did they just appear? You said we just discovered them in the last 10 months or so.
We did, because they can't. Gamma rays can't be seen visually, so they're only and they're blocked by our atmosphere. So it's only detected by a gamma ray observatory. And in fact, the gamma ray observatory is named Fermi, and that's why we call these the Fermi bubbles, because that's what discovered them. There's an idea that maybe it has something to do with dark matter, which makes up more of the universe than the visible matter that we can see. But dark matter doesn't really explain it either. So everybody's stumped.
Should we be worried about these bubbles?
No, because they're not really in our part of the galaxy, and they're spread out enough that they wouldn't hurt us anyway. So no, they can't harm us. They're just extremely strange.
Yeah. And how often, how many of the 50 that you have in the magazine are things that we can't explain at all and that are fairly new? Or are they oddities and weird things that have been there for a long time?
There's a mix. In some of the objects, we just deal with a planet. For example, Venus. We put Venus there even though it's the nearest planet and the brightest thing in the night sky, just because it's unique in so many different ways. And in none of those ways is it truly mysterious. It's just simply unique. For example, it's got a surface that's the hottest surface of any planet. It's even hotter than Mercury. It's the brightest thing in our sky. It's the celestial object that almost doesn't spin. It has the slowest rotation of any object in the known universe, so that makes it unique in that way. And there's seven separate facts about Venus that make it distinct from any other planet or object in the universe. So put together, we'd have to say, yeah, that's strange enough to include it. Plus, it snows there, even though it's as hot as an oven. But the snow isn't the kind of snow we're used to. It's a snow of lead, of white lead, that gets deposited on its mountains and comes and goes. So, all in all, totally bizarre.
And you talk about, I wanted you to explain this more, the temperature and atmospheric pressure rank higher than any other planet, so much so that its air distorts everything like a funhouse mirror.
Yes, the air is 90 times denser than what we have on Earth. So, a pressure cooker... remember those? People don't really use them.
Yes, I remember them. Sure.
I think people were always afraid they'd explode or something when they whistled to release their pressure. But a pressure cooker operates at double the atmosphere pressure. It makes everything twice as dense and pressurized inside as outside. Well, on Venus, it's not twice as pressurized. It's 90 times more pressurized than what we have on Earth. That plus that surface temperature of about 850 degrees, which is quite a bit hotter than an oven, means you could cook pot roast in about 1 second there. And yes, if you looked around, the air is so thick that everything would be distorted, and anybody standing near you would not really be in the position that they seem to be in.
You have an absolutely beautiful picture. It's the kind of thing you want to blow up and put on a poster, color-coded to highlight Venus's elevations in the magazine. Isn't it pretty?
That's very pretty. Frankly, I prefer the things that are true color to the color-coded ones. The color-coded ones, as you correctly say, give us information and let us in a moment say, oh, yeah, this makes this clear. But so some of the objects that we have, many of the objects of our 50 weirdest, are just plain pretty in real color as well. And my own personal preference is for that.
Yeah, they are. The pictures are just, you look at them and you say, I can't believe this is real. It's just, all of this just astounds me. I'm so envious of the knowledge that you have. I wish I could get there. I mean, it would take years and years to get there, but I wish I had it.
Well, thank you. And just as I wish I was able to cook instead of relying on people around me to do that.
Oh, you could do that. If you can do this, you can cook. I really think you could do that.
No, I'm too impatient. I would eat the ingredients before they made it there. So we all have things that that we admire in others.
Yeah. Well, black holes, are they weird?
They're weird. Yes. Yes, well, of course they're weird. I shouldn't say it in a qualifying kind of voice. But they're different from what we thought. Every galaxy has a black hole in its core, including our own Milky Way, which has one weighing the same as 4 million suns. And so black holes are kind of even common. What's strange about them is the way they distort space and time in their vicinity, because as they're collapsing into a black hole starts out weighing at least as much as 4 suns, and as it collapses smaller and smaller, the final bits of its body that are being pulled in to collapse to a black hole, a strange thing happens to itself. Yes, it keeps collapsing until it so distorts space and time that its escape velocity reaches the speed of light. In other words, even light can't escape from it. But it continues getting smaller and smaller until, well, our science fails. According to just relativity, if you used Einstein's relativity, it collapses to occupy no space at all and becomes of infinite density, which doesn't make any sense. We can't picture something that's infinitely dense or that occupies no space at all. So some physicists think that something else must stop the process when it's super tiny, and that maybe there's another force, like the strong force, that acts to stop it at that point. But we'll never find out because of the real oddity of black holes, which is that once you've passed beyond the point at a certain distance from it where the space and time is fully warped, in other words, the whole rest of the universe that's looking at it, including ourselves when we look in their direction, we don't see the black hole collapsing. We see the black hole start to collapse, and then it slows down, and then it freezes, and it never collapses anymore from our perspective. Hmm. So what we see is a frozen star, a star that's not going to move and not going to change forever. And it would take infinite time. There's infinity again. It would take infinite time for it to become a full black hole. So in a real sense, black holes don't exist. They never form, not in our reality, not in our universe, not to anyone outside of them. Only to the black hole itself does it collapse and form a black hole. To anyone outside of it, that never happens, and a black hole never comes into existence.
Hmm. Why is this, I don't know how to pronounce it, you've got this black hole Cygnus X1?
Yes, Cygnus X1.
Cygnus X1, why is that on the weird list?
Well, because that's the surest black hole in the night sky.
Mm.
There's a star in the lovely constellation of Cygnus, the Swan, right along the neck, Eta Cygni. And just half a degree from that, there's a binocular star. A star you can see with binoculars that goes by the catchy name of HDE 226868. Amazing that I remember these things.
And it sure is.
And this star is being yanked around about once a week. It makes a circle. Now, the only thing, and this is a very heavy star. It weighs at least 12 times what our sun does. So I don't have to tell you that the only thing that can whirl around a heavy star, like a sumo wrestler throwing around a rag doll, would be something that's even more massive and more dense. The problem is there's nothing there. Dense stars, massive stars, are always bright, but there's nothing there at all. So this star can't be just going around emptiness. And that's what leads us to say that this is a black hole. Plus, it's a source of intense X-rays. If you hold your hand up toward the overhead sky these nights where Cygnus is, you can almost see the bones in your hand. Oh. I'm actually exaggerating. You really can't. But there's X-rays coming from that spot.
Huh.
And that's what theory tells us should come from a black hole. Plus, the X-rays flicker, and they flicker rapidly. And that can only happen if the object is very tiny. So you put all the evidence together. This is like we can't see the black hole, but it's kind of like a case in court where it's circumstantial. We have an underluminous object, something that's obviously there because it's yanking the star around, but you can't see it. It's giving off X-rays, and the X-rays are flickering regularly but rapidly. All those things tell us that there is a black hole there, even though when you look at the place, you see no trace of it.
Let's go to this new star. Another gorgeous picture from the supernova. It gave rise to the Crab Nebula. It reached Earth in 1054 and was so bright the new star could be seen during the day for 3 weeks.
Yes, that's a supernova is an exploding star, and that was the second most recent one we've had in our galaxy. It happened on the 4th of July.
No.
Yeah, 4th of July, boom, suddenly a star that was the brightest thing in the sky that cast shadows that could even be seen in the daytime. And when we point telescopes there, we see the amazing Crab Nebula where material is just rushing outward still at about 1,000 miles a second.
Oh.
So quickly that we actually see it changing its shape. Every few years, you see photographs taken of it a few years later, and these tendrils, these snaking tentacles that are racing away from it are actually still moving outward visibly through our telescopes. And if that's not strange, the collapsed star in the center excuse me, is what's really strange, because that's all that's left of the star. Because when the outer parts of the star blasted itself into kingdom come, the core collapsed to be this tiny, teensy neutron star that's the size of Los Angeles. We're talking about 12 miles across, smaller than L.A., actually. So here you have a tiny star that's harder than a diamond. In fact, it's much harder than a diamond. It's on a gassy surface like our sun, but a solid surface that's at least 100,000 times denser than steel, so that if you tried to dent it, if you hit it with an H-bomb, an atomic bomb, and you try to make a little dent in it, you couldn't even do that,
if
you hit it with an A-bomb. So you don't have to insure it. I mean, you can't damage it. It's going to stay nice and smooth and shiny forever because you can't even make a little dent in it. And this is the Crab Pulsar. This star turns 30 times a second, spins 30 times a second, and as it does so, it sends, like a lighthouse, sends a flash of light to our eyes with every rotation, once every second. And as it does so, the material around it, its magnetism is so strong that all the little tiny atomic particles around it are forced to change their paths, which they don't like to do at all, so they glow with this weird blue light called synchrotron radiation, and you don't even see that except in particle accelerators on Earth. So this whole thing is glowing with a strange color that's not sunlight, it's not starlight, it's not heat, it's not atomic energy, it's this other kind of light itself that's lighting up the Crab Nebula, so no wonder it deserves to be on
Really? Oh, yeah, that could be number one in my book. It really could.
Yeah, but those Fermi bubbles,
I know.
We had to put that out.
I see what you're saying. Bob Berman is our guest, and his 50 Weirdest Objects in the Cosmos has just been published by Astronomy Magazine, Your Guide to the Strangest and Most Fascinating Oddities in the Universe. It's really interesting to read, and the pictures are just knockout gorgeous, and some of them are very weird. And inexplicable, which makes it even weirder, right? Here's our phone number. We invite you to join our conversation with Bob. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Bob, of course, one of the best known and most widely read astronomers in the world. He writes for Astronomy Magazine, Discover Magazine, The Old Farmer's Almanac, and the list goes on. We'll be with you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Bob. Let's start with Ray in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Good morning. This is a great show. I wish you could do one of these a month with astronomy. It'd be great. I have two questions, actually. One dealing with the Northern Lights, which everybody recently saw.
Oh, yes.
Somehow I missed them the other night.
I did, too.
Yeah. Now, I guess in 2005 or 2006 was the strongest coronal mass ejection ever witnessed here, an X-45 that reached Earth within a half hour, and scientists were baffled at that time how the particles reached us in a half hour, or normally it takes 2 days, I guess. But if you could talk about that little incident from a little bit back, and also there's this strange oddity on the North Pole of Saturn is a hexagonal-shaped windstorm, which is like the red spot on Jupiter, in that it's been there for years and years. I guess the Viking first spotted it, and now recently, if you go to the NASA website, I think it's Cassini, there are just some awesome shots of this storm there, mm-hmm. where the winds are going 300 miles an hour, and the storm is shaped in a six-sided shape, 15,000 miles across, I think.
And it's in the magazine. You may want to start with that, Bob.
Okay, yeah, we love that one, too. That's one of our top 10 strangest things in the universe, because storms, I don't have to tell you, are curvy things. So like the red spot on Jupiter, which is a giant cyclonic storm, is everything is curved. So how do you get a six-sided structure in nature? Well, we have them here on a small scale, ice crystals and snowflakes, but you sure wouldn't see a six-sided cloud, would you? And you sure wouldn't see one that persisted for years and years. Yet here this is, right smack on the northern pole of Saturn. Not only is it there, and not only do winds blow right through it without disturbing it, but it stands at least 60 miles tall. Mm. Each of its sides is about the width of Earth. And it rotates along with the rest of the planet, not at the same speed as the clouds in its vicinity, but at the same rate as the innermost, most solidmost parts of Saturn rotate, almost as if it's made of granite and it's affixed there. So how the heck do you get a hexagonal storm? Of course, that's your question. And the answer is nobody knows. We had a little bit of a clue when two Oxford researchers a couple of years ago, experts in fluid dynamics, showed that if you took a giant pail of water and glycol mixture on a turntable and you had a solid structure beneath it that wasn't rotating, a six-sided figure forms. So in fluid dynamics, you can get it, but there is something only a few feet across. Here, as you mentioned, we're talking about thousands of miles on each side of the hexagon. So that still doesn't begin to explain it. We think maybe it's some kind of standing wave, the way mountains occasionally have a cloud on the top that, even though the wind is blowing right through the clouds just remain. But that still doesn't explain it. Of course, the paranoid UFO crowd has gone crazy with this. Now that they've lost their face on Mars that they used to love, since better resolution has shown there really is no face on Mars, this is sort of a new substitute. And imaginative kind of new age explanation is that since it's located right at the north pole of Saturn, where no one can ever see it from Earth, no matter what kind of telescope, because it's right on the top, we'd be seeing it, you know, sideways. It could only be seen when we first sent spacecraft there. So perhaps it's analogous to that scene in 2001, A Space Odyssey, the Stanley Kubrick idea, that where you had a monolith on the crater Tycho on the moon, that this was planted there either by aliens or maybe God as sort of like a sign for human beings. Of course, what could the sign be? You know, maybe it's like a stop sign to tell us to stop making war. Now, that wouldn't work because the stop signs are eight-sided and this is six-sided. So there's really no explanation for it. I'm just trying to be a little funny here, but...
You are funny.
It's a total... utter puzzle, and that's why it even makes our top five of the strangest objects in the universe. Your other question was a lot less strange, because you said that strongest coronal mass ejection. Actually, the strongest blasts we've ever gotten to Earth were not then, but in 1859 and in 1921, when we got, those were the strongest that ever hit Earth. But that was a strong one. When you get a coronal mass ejection and it comes here in a very rapid way, usually it means that there was a previous storm, maybe undetected, that cleared the way, because there's a lot of solar wind between the sun and Earth. And in fact, in my new book, The Sun's Heartbeat, of course, the publisher always says, don't just say my new book, mention the title. So in The Sun's Heartbeat, we talk about all these coronal mass ejections and the fact that when this material from the sun gets here, it really won't affect Earth at all unless it has a magnetic polarity that's opposite to our own field. See, this swarm of material from the sun has its own magnetic field. Now, Earth's field, of course, is north up and south down. So if the blast, they're like a swarm of bees, if this blast of material from the sun has the opposite polarity, magnetic south up and north down, then, and only then, will it transfer its energy to Earth, and then will we get these auroras and other effects, bad effects, too, here on Earth. But if it has the same polarity as Earth, then it just sweeps right past us. It's channeled past the Earth by our magnetosphere, and it doesn't interact with us at all. And so that explains why a lot of these coronal mass ejections that seem to be something that can create a nice aurora winds up not doing so, because we only find out about the magnetic polarity when it passes the ACE spacecraft and the ACE and the SOHO that are parked only a million miles sunward of us, and that only gives us a couple of hours warning. So only then do we really know if it's going to affect us or not. When they're first observed, we don't really know. We can only say an aurora could happen.
Thank you, Ray, very much for the call. Charlie in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, how you doing? Wonderful show.
Thanks, Charlie.
I was just going to ask Dr. Berman what he thought of some of the common things that we encounter that are actually somewhat weird, and I was thinking things like water. Water has a whole bunch of unique properties that allows for life and allows for us to exist, yet, you know, how odd are some of the common things we encounter every day? Thanks much.
Oh, you're so right, and that's such a great idea that everyday life is amazing and unique and odd if you have eyes to see it. And of course, the great scientists through the ages, Newton and others, I think one of the reasons that they were so successful is that they looked at the world in just that way. They saw what so many of us see as commonplace, as marvelous. And you mentioned water, and that certainly qualifies. I mean, what other substance is densest, not after it freezes, but well before it freezes? Water has its maximum density at 39.5 degrees. And so that means when it's still a liquid, it's denser. And this keeps ponds from freezing thoroughly. It makes large bodies of water never freeze. And it's allowed life to form on Earth and maybe many other countless places as well. Yes, water itself. I mean, we could go on and on about water, but I know that's not what the program is about, so I'm going to have to edit myself and just kind of shut up at this point.
We'll talk about water some other time. Yeah. I want to talk about this, the largest star cluster in the Milky Way, and obviously we might be able to see it. Where do we look for this? Which you say... New evidence shows that it came from somewhere else, which of course prompted the question, where did it come from? And it is, it's spectacular. We probably know that we've seen it, but we didn't know what it was.
Yes, that's Omega Centauri, just a beautiful globular cluster. And listeners who have had friends who have a telescope, if you have a telescope yourself or have been invited to look through a good telescope from friends or neighbors, have probably been shown this beautiful globular cluster named M13 in Hercules, which is a city of suns packed together into a ball where there is close to a million suns in a ball-shaped configuration. Mm. Well, that's the prettiest one that we commonly see here because it's high overhead for us, especially those of us who live in the northern states. But people in the extreme southern states can see an even bigger and brighter and more spectacular ball of suns called Omega Centauri. And this one is the number one brightest globular cluster. And recent evidence has shown that it doesn't belong here. It came from elsewhere.
Oh.
And what it apparently is all that's left of a dwarf galaxy that came too close to our Milky Way and was sucked in and cannibalized, and the rest of the galaxy was ripped to shreds, and all that remains is its core, and that core is Omega Centauri.
Ooh, that could have been number two, couldn't it? It's number 36.
Oh, Kathleen, you're so easy to please.
I know. That's an incredible story.
Yes.
Oh, thank you, Charlie, very much for the call. Let's go to Sally in Middleton. Hi, Sally.
My mind is just boggled. I don't even know what you guys are talking about half of the time, and I'm not dumb. I'm ignorant, for sure. But I call about 25 minutes ago. There's a persistent question I have had. I'm bottom rung starting here. But I've always wondered if there is... I mean, I don't think of infinity, but it must be. I've always wondered where the universe ends. If there's a beginning, isn't there an end?
Well, that's the ancient question, and a corollary of that question, a common one that I get, is that if the universe is expanding, what is it expanding into? Which is kind of the same thing. Unfortunately, the way the human brain logic system works is we cannot picture infinity. We just can't. It's just not a concept that we can grasp, something that space that goes on and on and on and on without an end. Nor can we picture an end, because if there was a wall or barrier, an end to the universe, then we would immediately ask, well, then where does that thing that's outside of it end? So either way, it's not visualizable, and that's sort of new to a lot of people. It may have started with quantum physics in the 1920s and 30s, the idea that there are things that we can't picture, that are true, but that we can't picture. So I would say the best way to visualize the universe, what the universe is to picture yourself on a planet in a galaxy that's a member of a group of galaxies, and that all other groups of galaxies are moving away from ours, and that the groups of galaxies closest to us are moving away rather slowly, and that groups of galaxies that are farthest from us are rushing away from us at the fastest possible speed. Now, if you picture that, that's the best you can do that's still accurate. If you try to see the universe from the outside, as if you were an alien or God or something that had an outside perspective and see the whole universe as a whole, so that you're wondering about its boundary or you're wondering about its expanding and what it's expanding into, that will never work, because the universe, by definition, is everything. So there is no outside to an everything. So there's no such perspective as being outside of it and looking back toward the universe at its boundaries or its edges. So you're trying to have a viewpoint that just simply doesn't exist, and that's where the frustration arises. Mm.
And that may be the weirdest thing of all, don't you think?
It is.
Yeah. Sally, thank you so much for your call. Our phone number, we have lines open right now, is 800-486-8655. Bob Berman is our guest. Astronomy has a special issue, and it is titled Bob Berman's 50 Weirdest Objects in the Cosmos, Your Guide to the Strangest and Most Fascinating Oddities in the Universe. It's a really compelling magazine, and the pictures are just beautiful. So we welcome more of your phone calls, or if you want to send an email, you can do that as well. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Again, our number is 800-486-8655. Bob Berman is our guest. Astronomy Magazine special issue out this fall, Bob Berman's 50 Weirdest Objects in the Cosmos. And we go next to Ken, who's calling us from Oshkosh. Hi, Ken.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
By the way, a suggestion for you once again, Guy Murchie's Music of the Spheres will give you a basic knowledge of some of the stuff that you were talking about with these boys. For the gentleman, add an explanation for the Fermi bubbles. Years ago, I came across an equation for the formation of the event horizon for a black hole, which with our galaxy just happens to be about the size of the outer ring. Now, if you look at the spin on the black hole in the center and the accretion disk, which is our galaxy, what you may be seeing in those two areas is a, a lensed release of the Hawking radiation that would be coming from the black hole.
That doesn't work, my friend. That doesn't work. Because what we have here are twin expanding bubbles that are not centered on the black hole and are nowhere near the black hole. It would be as if that black hole was responsible for the material. It would be as if that black hole threw material, and we're talking about some tens of thousands of light years, and then from that point itself, a violent explosion began that continuously emitted the same gamma rays that we would expect from tens of thousands of exploding supernovae simultaneously.
Thanks for the call. Let's talk about this universe, this galaxy, 600 million light years away. And this picture is a gorgeous picture in the magazine. You got the yellow core and outer region of young blue stars, but the rest of it is missing.
Oh, yes.
Missing. It's just an extraordinary picture. Where is it?
That's right. It's Hoag's galaxy. And, you know, what's funny is that this thing is out. Of course, I wrote this months ago. And now when you describe it, I almost frantically saying to myself, all right, what is Kathleen? Which one is Kathleen?
Which one am I looking at?
Yeah,
right.
And then I got it. Boom. Hoag's object, as you've described, has to be the oddest galaxy of all, because we all know what a spiral galaxy looks like our own Milky Way or Andromeda. It's got a dense core that's usually kind of warm-colored, campfire-colored, oranges and yellows, and then beautiful cobalt spiral arms where the youngest stars are being made that radiate outward from it. Here, we have the outermost part of the spiral arms, in other words, a ring. We've got the core, and in between, there's nothing at all.
Yeah.
As if some malevolent alien spacecraft with some Darth Vader-like machine sucked up with a vacuum cleaner the entire middle section of the galaxy, through which you can see stars in the distance and things like that. And all that's left are the outermost parts in the center of the galaxy, and there's no explanation for why this could have happened. And then, just to make it a little strange, a ring galaxy like this, there's only a couple of those in the universe, and there's nothing quite like this one. Through the empty space in the ring, off in the distance, we see another one, another ring galaxy that's lined up in the same direction.
Oh, my. All right. Well, let's go to, where should we go? Sherry in Phillips. Hi, Sherry.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have a rather simple question, but I'm curious. in the desire to view some of these beautiful things that you're talking about, what kind of telescope would you recommend?
I'm going to be honest with you. Even though we have a lot of telescope sponsors in Astronomy Magazine, and they're going to hate me for saying this.
They're not listening.
Uh-oh.
Okay, good. Because
yes, they are.
The truth is this. Over and over again, over the years, I've seen people buy telescopes and use them once or twice, and then they're never used again. Because the truth is, although people imagine that the sky is filled with wonders and you can point a telescope almost anywhere and see something amazing, there are only about half a dozen objects, maybe 10 at most, that are truly dramatic through a backyard telescope. The Moon, Jupiter, Saturn, there's only a few of those. Secondly, nothing has color to it. We're used to all the beautiful photographs, like in the 50s, Weirdest Objects in the Universe, in any magazine or any textbook. We have all these colorful photos. But through a backyard telescope, everything is black and white. There are no colors because the eyes color mechanism, the cone-shaped cells that give us our color vision, are not activated by low light. And all galaxies and nebulae have too low a light, so everything is gray. Next, everything is blurry, because for the same reason, that in order to see sharp vision, you need enough light to produce what's called photopic vision, our daytime vision. At night, we don't have that. That's why in your room at night, if you're being illuminated only by a night light or a little light under the crack in the door, you'll notice that your rug doesn't show any detail or the floor pattern. Everything's just a blur. Well, same thing through a backyard telescope. Everything's blurry. Next, you can't use a telescope through a window, open or closed. You can't use it on a deck. You need it on a solid piece of ground. And they're heavy, so you have to lug it out for every use. Good telescopes come in pieces, so you take them apart, bring them out, reassemble them. Then you have to collimate the telescope, point it where it's going, and will you be able to recognize Saturn from among all the other look-alike stars in the night sky?
No.
Probably not. So you can't really find the things then. And finally, everything that you look at will drift out of view once you've found it in about a minute, thanks to Earth's rotation, unless you have what's called a clock drive that tracks everything, but the tracking will only work if you've set up the telescope exactly right from the beginning, and if it's the kind of telescope that has tracking, electric motors with tracking. So with all this fuss, people quickly learn that it's really not worth it, and that the better deal is probably to learn the stars and constellations or use binoculars and sweep the night sky, and it's a lot easier and a lot more fun. That having been said, those who develop a serious and continued interest in astronomy, like the youngsters or even not-so-youngsters, who find that every one of those smudges that's a galaxy is exciting because it's a galaxy,
right?
You know, and they have a continued interest in astronomy, then, yes, you want to spend money on a good telescope. For most people, I wouldn't even recommend it.
Well, I think you saved... I'm putting my pen away. I think you've saved me a lot of money for Christmas presents.
Thank you, Cherry. Thanks for the call.
Thank you. I hope I don't get fired.
You won't get fired. You got too much knowledge, and you're funny. But I'm wondering how... is there a place, because I'm really knocked out by these pictures, and I always am by looking at what the Hubble's given us and phenomenal telescopes. Is there a central place, Bob, to look at all the pictures have already been taken of?
Well, you mentioned a good site. The Hubble site has lots of archived images that are just breathtaking, and they'll let you download them for screensavers and stuff. And astronomy magazines, and the best one is Astronomy Magazine. And this issue has lots of pictures. We are also putting out another special issue that contains nothing, almost nothing but photographs, and is entitled something like The Most Beautiful Objects in the Universe, where you have page after page of just stunning, unique, astronomical objects.
Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Thanks, Sherry, for the call. Judy is next in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
Hi.
My grandsons and I were watching a movie the other night called Supernova, and on the other side was the black hole, which is what you were talking about. My grandsons asked me, the supernova was like a bunch of electricity that caused a fire, and they were falling to the earth. The boys asked me if something like that could ever happen. And I said, I don't know. So I'm asking you, could something like that ever really happen?
Not here, because the only stars that can form a supernova have to be quite a bit heavier than the sun. The sun is not the kind of star that in its old age collapses into a supernova. It collapses and then swells up into a red giant. That'll put an end to life on Earth, but that's billions of years in the future. An actual exploding star... Even the dog star Sirius, which is the nearest heavy star to us, that's 8.5 light years away, even Sirius only weighs 2.5 times what our sun does. And that's not heavy enough for a supernova, we don't think. So there really are no supernova candidates that are near enough to us to do us ill.
Hmm. Okay, well, I just thought that was interesting. They're 8 years old. They're studying these things in school. And they asked me a question that Grandma couldn't answer, so I thought I'd ask you.
No, that's great. The kids are so excited by astronomy. It's always great to see.
It sure is. Thank you, Judy.
Well, thank you.
Yeah,
very
thanks
much.
For your call. John in Elm Grove sends an email. Bob, please explain how astronomers predict or measure distances with such seeming accuracy. How can you really know that?
It's a ladder, Kathleen. We start off with the things that we can measure, and we do it trigonometrically using trigonometric parallax. Now, that means that right now, if you put a finger up, you raise your finger and put it in front of your face and blink one eye and then the other, and just do that and notice how the finger jumps back and forth relative to the background wall. See it happen? Well, just like that, as Earth goes around the sun, our star, our own sun, blinks back and forth, and nearer stars blink back and forth as we change our perspective relative to more distant stars. So when we measure it that way, we've really nailed it. We know exactly how far these stars are. Hmm. And in recent decades, there's been a what's called an astrometric satellite called Hipparchus that orbits Earth and does nothing but take these measurements of stars. And the measurements are very accurate out to several hundred light years.
Hmm.
So that's how we get the first few hundred light years. And then doing that, we see families of stars that have certain characteristics that tell us how bright they actually are. And so then we can compare them to how bright stars seem at different distances and then calculate what their brightness must be. And so we keep going outward further and further and further using one method standing on the other until we have the distance to galaxies, which often use the brightness of supernovae. Many galaxies have a supernova going off once a century or so. When that happens, we know how bright a supernova is, and so we can tell how bright the galaxy must be and therefore its distance.
Hmm. Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there again, Kathleen. Thanks.
Hi, Scott.
For having me on. Thanks.
Yeah.
For the wonderful program.
Sure.
I, as a resident of the universe myself, I'm very interested in this topic, and I have a website that I visit daily and highly recommend it, and it's Astronomy Picture of the Day, APOD. They have great archives. They do lots of interesting, fun
stuff. They do. I know that site. They do have pretty pictures every day, yes.
Great. So, you do great work. The program's great. I'm so happy to. I've been away for a little bit here and was not able to be around Wisconsin Public Radio, and I cannot tell you how much I missed it.
Oh, Scott.
You know, they got public radio in other states, but they don't have Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the best. I feel blessed to be with you guys.
Oh, thanks
so much.
Thank you, Scott. And I always love to hear from Scott. He's a great, great caller. Let's go to Gail in... Oh, we're almost out of time. We could go all day here, couldn't we? This is great fun. Gail in Fish Creek. Hi.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great show. In response to hearing, number one, about the crystals, isn't quartz crystal six-sided the way they grow? Because Marcel Vogel had done a lot of studies on quartz. And the crystals are six-sided, too, I think.
Absolutely,
but
yeah.
Number, the other ones with the telescopes and the kids studying astronomy, there's an application on the iPad that you can actually take the iPad outside at night and aim it at the stars, and it has a little camera in it, I guess, and it will tell you what the constellations are that you're looking at.
Oh, neat.
Yeah,
oh.
It's very cool. It's a very cool app. It's not the camera that does it. It's the gyroscope that's built inside the iPad. And the combination of the gyroscope itself, it's called Star Walk. That's the best of the programs, and it's only a few dollars. And absolutely, you just aim it at the sky, and it'll show you the constellations as it would appear. Put the likes of me out of business.
Yeah, well, we just got our iPad. We're getting ready to put that together and go out and check that out.
Oh, you'll love it.
You just made my weekend.
Yeah,
thanks,
Walk.
Gail. Thank you. That's great. That will be great, great fun. How did you learn all of this? How do you learn all of this, Bob?
Well, I've loved it since I was a kid. Actually, my first memory of my life was looking up at the night sky out of a carriage or a stroller or something. I don't think I had language then, but I remember looking up. The first thing I can remember. So I was one of those that memorized every star and its distance when I was a teenager, so I couldn't wait to study it in college. And so it's been a lifelong thing, really.
Mm-hmm. And it must, what a wonderful thing to know. I would imagine you have a lot of people who just want to be with you because of what you can teach them, right?
That would be nice. My wife and kids, I feel that way anyway.
Good. And those are the most important people to feel that way about you. No doubt about it. Well, we're out of time, so we have to say goodbye. Thank you for putting together this astronomy magazine on weird objects. It is really wonderful. And please, when your next book comes out, when is it coming out?
Oh, the Sun's Heartbeat is out now.
Oh, it's out now.
Yes.
Well, we need to get the book and then book you to talk about the Sun's Heartbeat.
I'd love to.
Great. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Bob Berman, 50 Weirdest Objects in the Cosmos. It has just been published, the fall issue of Astronomy, this special magazine, and is it's great. It's great. I didn't know about that iPad thing. I just got this iPad. I don't know what the heck I'm doing with it. But I'll learn that app. That's fabulous. What a great thing to do every night. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this highly interesting program, Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios, and thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. I'll be with you again next Tuesday on the Ideas Network.